From PRI, Public Radio International.
Nearing his stop, the palmist struggled to get up, wincing as he did. The teenager helped him and wanted to say something, but he did not. When the bus stopped, he flashed a smile instead and waved to the palmist, who in turn gave him a look that he would later interpret as that of impossible longing. Later, he would also perceive the palmist as the first of many true seers in his life, and realize that in the cosmic sense of things, their encounter was inevitable.
You're listening to James Naughton reading from Andrew Lamb's The Palmist, one of the four short fictions we'll hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Hi there, boys and girls. I'm Sheffero the Magnificent, and this program is about magic. We take four little stories, watch me, see that my fingers never leave my hands. We add four terrific actors, I sprinkle a little magic dust, wave my wand, and presto, a Selected Shorts program entitled A Touch of Magic. Our first trick is a story by Andrew Lamb called The Palmist, about a teenage boy's encounter on a bus with an unusual palm reader. Reading the story and the palm is the Tony Award-winning actor and director James Naughton.
The palmist closed up early because of the pains. He felt as if he was being roasted slowly from the inside out. By noon, he could no longer focus on his customers' palms, their life and love lines having all failed to point to any significant future, merging instead with the rivers and streams of his memories. Outside, the weather had turned. Dark clouds hung low and the wind was heavy with moisture. He reached the bus stop's tiny shelter when it began to pour. He didn't have to wait long, however. The good old 38 Geary pulled up in a few minutes, and he felt mildly consoled, though sharp pains flared and blossomed from deep inside his bowels like tiny geysers and made each of his three steps up the bus laborious. It was warm and humid on the crowded bus, and a fine mist covered all windows. The palmist sat on the front bench facing the aisle, the one reserved for the handicapped and the elderly. A fat woman who had rosy cheeks and who did not take the seat gave him a dirty look. It was true. His hair was still mostly black, and he appeared to be a few years short of senior citizenship. The palmist pretended not to notice her. Contemptuously, he leaned back against the worn and cracked vinyl and smiled to himself. He closed his eyes. A faint odor of turned earth reached his nostrils. He inhaled deeply and saw again a golden rice field, a beatific smile, a face long gone, his first kiss. The rain pounded the roof as the bus rumbled toward the sea. At the next stop, a teenager got on. Caught in the downpour without an umbrella, he was soaking wet, and his extra-large T-shirt, which said, "Play hard, stay hard," clung to him. It occurred to the palmist that this was the face of someone who hadn't yet learned to be fearful of the weather. The teenager stood, towering above the palmist and blocking him from seeing the woman, who, from time to time, continued to glance disapprovingly at him. So young, the palmist thought. The age of my youngest son, maybe, had he lived. The palmist tried to conjure up his son's face, but could not. It had been some years since the little boy drowned in the South China Sea, along with his two older sisters and their mother. The palmist had escaped on a different boat, a smaller one that had left a day after his family's boat, and as a result reached America alone. Alone, thought the palmist, and sighed. Alone. It was then that his gaze fell upon the teenager's hand, and he saw something. He leaned forward and did what he had never done before on the 38 Geary. He spoke up loudly, excitedly, "You," he said in his heavy accent, "I see wonderful life." The teenager looked down at the old man and arched his eyebrows. "I'm a palmist. Maybe you give me your hand?" the palmist said. The teenager did nothing. No one had ever asked to see his hand on the bus. The fat woman snickered. Oh, she'd seen it all on the 38 Geary. She was not surprised. "This, my last reading. No money. Free. Gift for you," the palmist pressed on. "Give me your hand." "You know," the teenager said, scratching his chin. He was nervous. I don't know. He felt as if he'd been caught inside a moving greenhouse, and that with the passengers looking on, he had somehow turned into one of its most conspicuous plants. What you don't know?" asked the palmist. "Maybe I know. Maybe I answer." "Dude," the teenager said, "I don't know if I believe in all that hocus-pocus stuff." And though he didn't say it, he didn't know whether he wanted to be touched by the old man with the wrinkled, bony hands and the nauseating tobacco breath. To stall, the teenager said, I have a question, though. Can you read your own future? Can you, like, tell when you're going to die and stuff?" Then he thought about it and said, Nah, forget it. And sorry, that was stupid. The bus driver braked abruptly at the next stop, and all the people standing struggled to stay on their feet. But those near the front of the bus were also struggling to listen to the conversation. No, not stupid," said the palmist. "Good question. Long ago, I ask same thing. I read same story in many hands of my people. Story that said something bad will happen. Disaster. But in my hand here, I read only good thing. This line here, see? Say I have happy family, happy future. No problem. So I think, me, my family, no problem. Now, I know better. All hands affect each other. All lines run into each other, tell a big story. When the war ended in my country, you know, it was so bad for everybody. And my family? Gone under the sea. You know, reading palm, not like reading map." He touched his chest. "You feel and see here in heart also, in guts here also, not just here in your head. It is, how do you say, a tuition."
"Intuition," teenager corrected him, stifling a giggle.
"Yes," nodded the palmist. "Intuition." The teenager liked the sound of the old man's voice. Its timbre reminded him of the voice of his long-dead grandfather, who also came from another country, one whose name had changed several times as a result of wars. "My stop not far away now," the palmist continued. "This your last chance, free, no charge."
"Go on, kiddo,"
the fat woman said, nudging the boy with her elbow and smiling. She wanted to hear his future.
"I've been listening. It's all right. He's for real. I can tell now."
That was what the boy needed.
"Okay,"
he said. Then he opened his right fist like a flower and presented it to the palmist. The old man's face burned with seriousness as he leaned down and traced the various lines and contours and fleshy knolls on the teenager's palm. He bent the boy's wrist this way and that, kneaded and poked the fingers and knuckles as if to measure the strength of his resolve. In his own language, he made mysterious calculations and mumbled a few sing-song words to himself. Finally, the palmist looked up and in a solemn voice spoke. "You will become artist. When 25, 26, you're going to change very much. If you don't choose right, oh, so many regrets. But don't be afraid. Never be afraid. Move forward. Always. You have help. These squares here, right here, see? their spirits and mentors. They come protect, guide you. When you reach mountaintop, people everywhere will hear you, know you, see you. Your art, what you see, others will see. Oh, so much love. You, number one someday. Inspired, the palmist went on like this for some time. Despite his pains, which flared up intermittently, the old man went on to speak of the ordinary palms and sad faces he had read, the misfortunes he had seen coming, and the wondrous opportunities squandered as a result of fear and distrust. Divorces, marriages, deaths in families, of these he had read too many. Broken vows, betrayals, and adulteries too pedestrian to remember. Twice, however, he had held hands that committed unspeakable evil, and each time he was sick for a week. And once, he held the hand of a reincarnated saint. How many palms had he read since his arrival in America? Oh, so many, he said, laughing. Too many, thousands. Who care now, not me? When the palmist finished talking, the teenager retrieved his hand and looked at it. It seemed heavy and foreign. Most of what the palmist had said made no sense to him. Sure, he loved reading a good book now and then. Reading was like being inside a cartoon. But he loved cartoons even more. And even if he got good grades, he hated his stupid English classes. Though it's true that he did write poetry, but only for himself. He also played the piano, a singer, maybe a computer graphic artist, maybe a movie star. He didn't know. Everything was still possible. Besides, turning 25 was so far away, almost a decade. Before she got off the bus, the fat lady touched the teenager lightly on the shoulder. "Lots of luck, kiddo," she said and smiled, a sad, wistful smile. Nearing his stop, the palmist struggled to get up, wincing as he did. The teenager helped him and wanted to say something, but he did not. When the bus stopped, he flashed a smile instead and waved to the palmist, who in turn gave him a look that he would later interpret as that of impossible longing. Later, he would also perceive the palmist as the first of many true seers in his life, and realize that, in the cosmic sense of things, their encounter was inevitable. At that moment, however, all he saw was a small and sad-looking old man whose eyes seemed on the verge of tears as he quietly nodded before stepping off the bus and into the downpour. The teenager lived near the end of the line, past the park. As usual, the bus was nearly empty on this stretch, and he moved to the bench the palmist had occupied. He could still feel the warmth of the vinyl and felt insulated by it somehow. With nearly everyone gone, he grew bored. He turned to the befogged window behind him and drew a sailor standing on a sloop and holding a bottle. The ocean was full of dangerous waves. The boat, it seemed, was headed toward a girl who had large round breasts and danced in a hula skirt on a distant shore. He drew a few tall mountains and swaying palm trees behind her. He hesitated before mischievously giving her 2-3 more heads and 8 or 9 more arms than she needed to entice the drunken sailor to her island. And then he pulled back to look at what he had done. The scene made him chuckle to himself. Through his drawing, the teenager saw a rushing world of men, women, and children under black, green, red, blue, polka-dotted umbrellas and plastic ponchos. He watched until the people and storefront windows streaked into green. Pine trees, fern groves, placid lakes, and well-tended grass meadows. The park, beyond which was the sea. The rain tapered off, and a few columns of sunlight pierced the gray clouds, setting the road aglow like a golden river. The boy couldn't wait to get off the bus and run or do something. Soar above the clouds if he could. In the sky, jumbo jets and satellites gleamed. People were talking across borders, time zones, oceans, continents. People were flying to marvelous countries, to mysterious destinies. With repeated circular movements of his hand, he wiped away sailor, boat, waves, and girl. Where the palmist's thumbnail had dug into the middle of his palm and made a crescent moon, he could still feel a tingling sensation. "A poet not," he said to himself and giggled. Then he shook his head and looked at his cool, wet palm before wiping it clean on his faded Levi's.
The Palmist by Andrew Lamb, read by James Naughton. H.H. Munro, better known as Saki, wrote the next story, The Occasional Garden. It tells the story of a lady who simply could not meet the demands of keeping her London garden up to snuff to compete with the gardens of others in her social circles, and who therefore had to resort to extraordinary means. Appropriately enough, this story was read in one of our programs at The Mount, the Lenox, Massachusetts home of Edith Wharton, an estate with sumptuous gardens and landscaping. Of course, Miss Wharton never had to resort to subterfuge of any kind. The reader is the actor and director Daniel Gerrell.
"Don't talk to me about town gardens," said Eleanor Rapsley. "Which means, of course, that I want you to listen to me for an hour or so while I talk about nothing else. What a nice-sized garden you've got," people said to us when we first moved here. What I suppose they meant to say was, what a nice-sized site for a garden we've got. As a matter of fact, the size is all against it. It's too large to be ignored altogether and treated as a yard, and it's too small to keep giraffes in. You see, if we could keep giraffes or reindeer or some other species of browsing animal there, we could explain the general absence of vegetation by a reference to the fauna of the garden. You can't have Wapiti and Darwin tulips, you know? So we didn't put down any bulbs last year. As it is, we haven't got the Wapiti, and the Darwin tulips haven't survived the fact that most of the cats of the neighbourhood hold a parliament in the centre of the tulip bed. That rather forlorn-looking strip that we intended to be a border of alternating geranium and spiraea has been utilised by the cat parliament as a division lobby. Snap decisions seem to have been rather frequent of late. Far more frequent than geranium blooms are likely to be. I shouldn't object so much to ordinary cats, but I do complain of having a congress of vegetarian cats in my garden. They must be vegetarians, my dear, because whatever ravages they may commit among the sweet pea seedlings, they never seem to touch the sparrows. There are always just as many adult sparrows in the garden on Saturday as there were on Monday, not to mention newly fledged additions. There seems to have been an irreconcilable difference of opinion between sparrows and Providence since the beginning of time as to whether a crocus looks best standing upright with its roots in the earth or in a recumbent posture with its stem neatly severed. The sparrows always have the last word in the matter, at least in our garden they do. I fancy that Providence must have originally intended to bring an amending act, or whatever it's called, providing either for a less destructive sparrow or a more indestructible crocus. The one consoling point about our garden is that it's not visible from the drawing room or the smoking room, so unless people are dining or lunching with us, they can't spy out the nakedness of the land. That is why I am so furious with Gwenda Pottingdon, who has practically forced herself on me for lunch on Wednesday next. She heard me offer the Paulcott girl lunch if she was up shopping on that day, and of course she asked if she might come too. She's only coming to gloat over my bedraggled and flowerless borders and to sing the praises of her own detestably over-cultivated garden. I'm sick of being told that it's the envy of the neighborhood. It's like everything else that belongs to her. Her car, her dinner parties, even her headaches. They're all superlative. No one else has ever had anything like them. When her eldest child was confirmed, it was such a sensational event, according to her account of it, that one almost expected questions to be asked about it in the House of Commons. And now she's coming on purpose to stare at my few miserable pansies and the gaps in my sweet pea border and to give me a glowing, full-length description of the rare and sumptuous blooms in her rose garden. My dear Eleanor, said the Baroness, you should save yourself all this heart-burning and a lot of gardener's bills, not to mention sparrow anxieties, simply by paying an annual subscription to the OOSA. I never heard of it, said Eleanor. What is it? The Occasional Oasis Supply Association, said the Baroness. It exists to meet cases exactly like yours. Cases of backyards that are of no practical use for gardening purposes, but are required to blossom into decorative scenic backgrounds at stated intervals. When a luncheon or dinner party is contemplated, supposing, for instance, you have people coming to lunch at 1:30, you just ring up the association at about 10 o'clock the same morning and say, lunch garden. That is all the trouble you have to take. By 12:45, your yard is carpeted with a strip of velvety turf, with a hedge of lilac or red may, or whatever happens to be in season. As a background, one or two cherry trees in blossom and clumps of heavily flowered rhododendrons filling in the corners. In the foreground, you have a blaze of carnations or Shirley poppies or tiger lilies in full bloom. As soon as the lunch is over and your guests have departed, the garden departs also. And all the cats in Christendom can sit in council in your yard without causing you a moment's anxiety. If you have a bishop or an antiquary or something of that sort coming to lunch, you just mention the fact when you are ordering the garden, and you get an old-world pleasance with clipped yew hedges and a sundial and hollyhocks and perhaps a mulberry tree, borders of sweet williams and Canterbury bells, and an old-fashioned beehive or two tucked away in a corner. Those are the ordinary lines of supply that the Oasis Association undertakes, but by paying a few guineas a year extra, you are entitled to its emergency EON service. What on earth is an EON service? It's just like a conventional signal to indicate special cases like the incursion of Gwenda Pottingdon. It means you've got someone coming to lunch or dinner whose garden is alleged to be the envy of the neighbourhood. Yes! Exclaimed Eleanor. Exclaimed Eleanor with some excitement. And what happens then? Something that sounds like a miracle out of the Arabian Nights. Your backyard becomes voluptuous with pomegranate and almond trees, lemon groves, and hedges of flowering cactus, dazzling banks of azaleas, marble basined fountains in which chestnut and white pond herons step daintily amid exotic water lilies, while golden pheasants strut about on alabaster terraces. The whole effect rather suggests the idea that Providence and Norman Wilkinson had dropped mutual jealousies and collaborated to produce a background for an open-air Russian ballet. In point of fact, it is merely the background to your luncheon party. If there is any kick left in Gwenda Pottingdon or whoever your EON guest of the moment may be, just mention carelessly that your climbing putella is the only one in England since the one at Chatsworth died last winter. There isn't such a thing as a climbing putella, but But Gwenda Pottingdon and her kind don't usually know one flower from another without prompting. Quick, said Eleanor, the address of the association. Gwenda Pottingdon did not enjoy her lunch. It was a simple yet elegant meal, excellently cooked and daintily served, but the piquant sauce of her own conversation was notably lacking. She had prepared a long succession of eulogistic comments on the wonders of her town garden with its unrivaled effects of horticultural magnificence, and, behold, her theme was shut in on every side by the luxuriant hedge of Siberian berberis that formed a glowing background to Eleanor's bewildering fragment of fairyland, the pomegranate and lemon trees, the terraced fountain where golden carp slithered and wriggled amid the roots of gorgeous hued irises, the banked masses of exotic blooms, the pagoda-like enclosure where Japanese sand badgers disported themselves. All these contributed to take away Gwenda's appetite and moderate her desire to talk about gardening matters. I can't say I admire the climbing putella, she observed shortly. And anyway, it's not the only one of its kind in England. I happen to know of one in Hampshire. How gardening is going out of fashion. I suppose people haven't the time for it nowadays. Altogether, it was quite one of Eleanor's most successful luncheon parties. It was distinctly an unforeseen catastrophe that Gwenda should have burst in on the household 4 days later at lunchtime and made her way unbidden into the dining room. I thought I must tell you that my Elaine has had a watercolour sketch accepted by the Latent Talent Art Guild. It's to be exhibited at their summer exhibition at the Hackney Gallery. It will be the sensation of the moment in the art world. Hello? What on earth has happened to your garden? It's not there. Suffragettes, said Eleanor promptly. Didn't you hear about it? They broke in and made hay of the whole thing in about 10 minutes. I was so heartbroken at the havoc that I had the whole place cleared out. I shall have it laid out again on rather more elaborate lines. That, she said to the Baroness afterwards, is what I call having an emergency brain.
Daniel Jerrell read Saki's The Occasional Garden. We'll be back after a break with stories by Donald Barthelme and Haruki Murakami. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Our next story, which is read by the wonderful Maria Tucci, is Donald Barthelme's The Balloon. It might be more precise to call this story surreal rather than magical. A big balloon appears in the sky over Manhattan, soon occupying an area 45 blocks long and several avenue blocks wide. Nobody knows why or from where or what it signifies, if anything. What do people do? What do they think? Donald Barthelme's The Balloon.
The balloon, beginning at a point on 14th Street, the exact location of which I cannot reveal, expanded northward all one night while people were sleeping until it reached the park. There I stopped it. At dawn, the northernmost edges lay over the plaza. The free-hanging motion was frivolous and gentle. But experiencing a faint irritation at stopping, even to protect the trees, and seeing no reason the balloon should not be allowed to expand upward over the parts of the city it was already covering, into the airspace to be found there, I asked the engineers to see to it. This expansion took place throughout the morning, a soft, imperceptible sighing of gas through the valves. The balloon then covered 45 blocks north-south, and an irregular east-west, as many as 6 crosstown blocks on either side of the avenue in some places. That was the situation then. But it is wrong to speak of situations, implying sets of circumstances leading to some resolution, some escape of tension. There were no situations, simply the balloon hanging there. Muted, heavy grays and browns for the most part, contrasting with walnut and soft yellows. A deliberate lack of finish enhanced by skillful installation gave the surface a rough, forgotten quality. Sliding weights on the inside, carefully adjusted, anchored the great vary-shaped mass at a number of points. Now, we've had a flood of original ideas in all media, works of singular beauty as well as significant milestones in the history of inflation. But at that moment, there was only this balloon, concrete, particular, hanging there. There were some reactions. Some people found the balloon interesting, and as a response, this seemed inadequate to the immensity of the balloon, the suddenness of its appearance over the city. On the other hand, in the absence of hysteria or other societally induced anxiety, it must be judged a calm, mature one. There was a certain amount of initial argumentation about the meaning of the balloon. This subsided because we've learned not to insist on meanings, and they are rarely even looked for now, except in cases involving the simplest, safest phenomena. It was agreed that since the meaning of the balloon could never be known absolutely, extended discussion was pointless, or at least less meaningful than the activities of those who, for example, hung green and blue paper lanterns from the warm gray underside in certain streets, or seized the occasion to write messages on the surface announcing their availability for the performance of unnatural acts or the availability of acquaintances. Daring children jumped, especially at those points where the balloon hovered close to a building so that the gap between balloon and building was a matter of a few inches, or points where the balloon actually made contact, exacting an ever so slight pressure against the side of a building so that balloon and building seemed a unity. The upper surface was so structured that a landscape was presented. Small valleys as well as slight knolls or mounds. Once atop the balloon, a stroll was possible, or even a trip from one place to another. There was pleasure in being able to run down an incline, then up the opposing slope, both gently graded, or in making a leap from one side to the other. Bouncing was possible because of the pneumaticity of the surface, and even falling, if that was your wish. That all these varied motions, as well as others, were within one's possibilities in experiencing the upside of the balloon was extremely exciting for children accustomed to the city's flat, hard skin. But the purpose of the balloon was not to amuse children. Two, the number of people, children and adults, who took advantage of the opportunities described was not so large as it might have been. A certain timidity, lack of trust in the balloon was seen. There was furthermore some hostility, because we'd hidden the pumps which fed helium to the interior, and because the surface was so vast that the authorities could not determine the point of entry, that is, the point at which the gas was injected, a degree of frustration was evidenced by those city officers into whose province such manifestations normally fell. The apparent purposelessness of the balloon was vexing, as was the fact that it was there at all. Had we painted in great letters, "Laboratory tests prove," or 18% more effective on the sides of the balloon, this difficulty would have been circumvented, but I could not bear to do so. On the whole, these officers were remarkably tolerant, considering the dimensions of the anomaly, this tolerance being the result of, first, secret tests conducted by night that convinced them that little or nothing could be done in the way of removing or destroying the balloon, and, secondly, a public warmth that arose, not uncolored by touches of the aforementioned hostility, toward the balloon from ordinary citizens. As a single balloon must stand for a lifetime of thinking about balloons, so each citizen expressed, in the attitude he chose, a complex of attitudes. One man might consider that the balloon had to do with the notion sullied, as in the sentence, "The big balloon sullied the otherwise clear and radiant Manhattan sky." That is, the balloon was, in this man's view, an imposture, something inferior to the sky that had formerly been there, something interposed between the people and their sky. But in fact, it was January. The sky was dark and ugly. It was not a sky you could look up into, lying on your back in the street with pleasure, unless pleasure for you proceeded from having been threatened, from having been misused. And the underside of the balloon, by contrast, was a pleasure to look up into. We'd seen to that. Muted grays and browns, for the most part, contrasted with walnut and soft, forgotten yellows. And so while this man was thinking sullied, there still was an admixture of pleasurable cognition in his thinking, struggling with the original perception. Another man, on the other hand, might view the balloon, as it were, part of a system of unanticipated rewards, as one's employer walks in and says, "Here, Henry, take this package of money I've wrapped up for you, because we've been doing so well in the business here, and I admire the way you bruise the tulips, without which bruising your department would not be a success, or at least not the success that it is." For this man, the balloon might be a brilliant, heroic, muscle and pluck experience, even if an experience poorly understood. Another man might say, "Without the example of blank, it is doubtful that blank would exist today in its present form," and find many to agree with him or to argue with him. Ideas of bloat and float were introduced, as well as concepts of dream and responsibility. Others engaged in remarkably detailed fantasies having to do with a wish either to lose themselves in the balloon or engorge it. The private character of these wishes, of their origins deeply buried and unknown, was such that they were not much spoken of. Yet there is evidence that they were widespread. It was also argued that what was important was what you felt when you stood under the balloon. Some people claimed that they felt sheltered, warmed as never before, while enemies of the balloon felt or reported feeling constrained, a heavy feeling. Critical opinion was divided. Monstrous pourings, harp, XXXX, certain contrasts with darker portions, inner joy, large square corners, conservative eclecticism that has so far governed modern balloon design, :, abnormal vigor, warm, soft, lazy passages. Has unity been sacrificed for a sprawling quality? Or, quelle catastrophe? And, munching. People began in a curious way to locate themselves in relation to aspects of the balloon, albeit that place where it dips down into 47th Street almost to the sidewalk near the Alamo Chili House. Or, why don't we go stand on top and take the air and maybe walk about a bit, where it forms a tight curving line with the facade of the Gallery of Modern Art? Marginal intersections offered entrances within a given time duration, as well as warm, soft, lazy passages in which, but it is wrong to speak of marginal intersections. Each intersection was crucial. None could be ignored. As if walking there, you might not find someone capable of turning your attention in a flash from old exercises to new exercises. Each intersection was crucial. Meeting of balloon and building, meeting of balloon and man, meeting of balloon and balloon. It was suggested that what was admired about the balloon was finally this, that it was not limited or defined. Sometimes a bulge, blister, or subsection would carry all the way east to the river on its own initiative, in the manner of an army's movements on a map, as seen in headquarters remote from the fighting. Then that part would be, as it were, thrown back again or would withdraw into new dispositions. The next morning that part would have made another sortie or disappeared altogether. The ability on the part of the balloon to shift its shape to change was very pleasing, especially to people whose lives were rather rigidly patterned, people to whom change, although desired, was not available. The balloon, for the 22 days of its existence, offered the possibility, in its randomness, of getting lost, of losing oneself, in contradistinction to the grid of precise rectangular pathways under our feet. The amount of specialized training currently needed and the consequent desirability of long-term commitments has been occasioned by the steadily growing importance of complex machinery in virtually all kinds of operations. As this tendency increases, more and more people will turn, in bewildered inadequacy, to solutions for which the balloon may stand as a prototype or rough draft. I met you under the balloon on the occasion of your return from Norway. You asked if it was mine. I said it was. The balloon, I said, is a spontaneous autobiographical disclosure having to do with the unease I felt at your absence and with sexual deprivation. But now that your visit to Bergen has been terminated, it is no longer necessary or appropriate. Removal of the balloon was easy. Trailer trucks carried away the depleted fabric, which is now stored in West Virginia, awaiting some other time of unhappiness, some time, perhaps, when we are angry with one another.
Maria Tucci read Donald Barthelme's tale, The Balloon. A balloon in the sky, okay, but what if something scary and maybe magical comes even closer to hand, as in our final story, The Little Green Monster, by the magical Japanese fiction writer Haruki Murakami. What does one do? Make friends? Wish it away? Head for the hills? Listen as Dana Ivey reads.
My husband left for work as usual, and I couldn't think of anything to do. I sat alone in the chair by the window, staring out at the garden through the gap between the curtains. Not that I had any reason to be looking at the garden. There was nothing else for me to do. And I thought that sooner or later, if I sat there looking, I might think of something. Of all the many things in the garden, the one I looked at most was the oak tree. It was my special favorite. I had planted it when I was a little girl and watched it grow. I thought of it as my old friend. I talked to it all the time in my head. That day, too, I was probably talking to the oak tree. I don't remember what about. And I don't know how long I was sitting there. The time slips by when I'm looking at the garden. It was dark before I knew it. I must have been there quite a while. Then, all at once, I heard a sound. It came from somewhere far away, a funny, muffled sort of rubbing sort of sound. At first, I thought it was coming from a place deep inside me that I was hearing things, a warning from the dark cocoon my body was spinning within. I held my breath and listened. Yes, no doubt about it. Little by little, the sound was moving closer to me. What was it? I had no idea, but it made my flesh creep. The ground near the base of the tree began to bulge upward, as if some thick, heavy liquid were rising to the surface. Again, I caught my breath. Then the ground broke open, and the mounded earth crumbled away to reveal a set of sharp claws. My eyes locked onto them, and my hands turned into clenched fists. Something's going to happen, I said to myself. It's starting now. The claws scraped hard at the soil, and soon the break in the earth was an open hole from which there crawled a little green monster. Its body was covered with shining green scales. As soon as it emerged from the hole, it shook itself until the bits of soil clinging to it dropped away. It had a long, funny nose, the green of which gradually deepened toward the tip. The very end was narrow and pointed as a whip. But the beast's eyes were exactly like a human's. The sight of them sent a shiver through me. They showed feelings just like your eyes or mine. Without hesitation, but moving slowly and deliberately, the monster approached my front door, on which it began to knock with the slender tip of its nose. The dry, rapping sound echoed through the house. I tiptoed to the back room, hoping the beast would not realize I was there. I couldn't scream. Ours is the only house in the area, and my husband wouldn't be coming back from work until late at night. I couldn't run out the back door either, since my house has only one door, the very one on which a horrible green monster was now knocking. I breathed as quietly as I could, pretending not to be there, hoping the thing would give up and go away. But it didn't give up. Its nose went from knocking to groping at the lock. It seemed to have no trouble at all clicking the lock open. And then the door itself opened a crack. Around the edge of the door crept the nose. And then it stopped. For a long time, it stayed still, like a snake, with its head raised, checking conditions in the house. If I had known this was going to happen, I could have stayed by the door and cut the nose off, I told myself. The kitchen had plenty of sharp knives. No sooner had the thought occurred to me than the creature moved past the edge of the door, smiling as if it had read my mind. Then it spoke, not with a stutter, but repeating certain words as if it were still trying to learn them. "It wouldn't have done you any good, the little green monster said. "My nose is like a lizard's tail. It always grows back, stronger and longer, stronger and longer. You'd get just the opposite of what you want. Then it spun its eyes for a long time, like two weird tops. "Oh, no," I thought to myself. "Can it read people's minds? I hate to have anyone know what I'm thinking, especially when that someone is a horrid and inscrutable little creature like this." I broke out in a cold sweat from head to foot. What was this thing going to do to me? Eat me? Take me down into the earth? Oh, well, at least it wasn't so ugly that I couldn't stand looking at it. That was good. It had slender, pink little arms and legs jutting out from its green-scaled body and long claws at the ends of its hands and feet. They were almost darling the more I looked at them. And I could see, too, that the creature meant me no harm. "Of course not," it said to me, cocking its head. Its scales clicked against one another when it moved, like crammed together coffee cups rattling on a table when you nudge it. "What a terrible thought, madam. Of course I wouldn't eat you. No, 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 I mean you no harm, no harm, no harm." So I was right. It knew exactly what I was thinking. Madam, 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 don't you see, don't you see? I've come here to propose to you. From deep, deep, deep down, deep down, deep, I had to crawl all the way up here, up here, up. Awful. It was awful. I had to dig and dig and dig. Look at how it ruined my claws. I could never have done this if I meant you any harm, any harm, any harm. I love you. I love you so much I couldn't stand it anymore. Down deep, down deep. I crawled my way up to you. I had to. I had to. They all tried to stop me, but I couldn't stand it anymore. And think of the courage that it took. Please, took. What if you thought it was rude and presumptuous for a creature like me to propose to you? But it is rude and presumptuous, I said in my mind. What a rude little creature you are to come seeking my love. A look of sadness came over the monster's face as soon as I thought this, and its scales took on a purple tinge, as if to express what it was feeling. Its entire body seemed to shrink a little, too. I folded my arms to watch these changes occurring. Maybe something like this would happen whenever its feelings altered. And maybe its awful-looking exterior masked a heart that was as soft and vulnerable as a brand-new marshmallow. If so, I knew I could win. I decided to give it a try. You are an ugly little monster, you know, I shouted in my mind's loudest voice, so loud that it made my heart reverberate. You are an ugly little monster. The purple of the scales grew deeper, and the thing's eyes began to bulge, as if they were sucking in all the hatred I was sending them. They protruded from the creature's face like ripe green figs, and tears like red juice ran down from them, splattering on the floor. I wasn't afraid of the monster anymore. I painted pictures in my mind of all the cruel things I wanted to do to it. I tied it down to a heavy chair with thick wires, and with a needle-nose pliers, I began ripping out its scales at the roots, one by one. I heated the point of a sharp knife, and with it I cut deep grooves in the soft pink flesh of its calves. Over and over, I stabbed a hot soldering iron into the bulging figs of its eyes. With each new torture I imagined for it, the monster would lurch and writhe and wail in agony, as if those things were actually happening to it. It wept its colored tears and oozed thick gobs of liquid onto the floor, emitting a gray vapor from its ears that had the fragrance of roses. Its eyes sent an unnerving glare of reproach at me. Please, madam, oh please, I beg of you, don't think such terrible thoughts, it cried. I have no evil thoughts for you. I would never harm you. All I feel for you is love. Is love. But I refused to listen. In my mind, I said, don't be ridiculous. You crawled out of my garden. You unlocked my door without permission. You came inside my house. I never asked you here. I have the right to think anything I want to. And I continued to do exactly that, thinking at the creature increasingly terrible thoughts. I cut and tormented its flesh with every machine and tool I could think of, overlooking no method that might exist to torture a living being and make it writhe in pain. See then, you little monster, you have no idea what a woman is. There's no end to the number of things I can think of to do to you. But soon the monster's outlines began to fade, and even its strong green nose shriveled up until it was no bigger than a worm. Writhing on the floor, the monster tried to move its mouth and speak to me, struggling to open its lips as if it wanted to leave me some final message, to convey some ancient wisdom, some crucial bit of knowledge that it had forgotten to impart to me. Before that could happen, the mouth attained a painful stillness, and soon it went out of focus and disappeared. The monster now looked like nothing more than a pale evening shadow. All that remained, suspended in the air, were its mournful, bloated eyes. "That won't do any good," I thought to it. "You can look all you want, but you can't say a thing. You can't do a thing. Your existence is over, finished, done." Soon the eyes dissolved into emptiness, and the room filled with the darkness of night.
Dana Ivey read The Little Green Monster by Haruki Murakami. Many of these stories have magical elements, a theme we've explored on our new selected short CD, A Touch of Magic. You can find more information about the CD set at selectedshorts.org. And if you would like a free reading list telling about all the stories you hear on this program and where they can be found in print, that information is also at selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Scheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Atchison Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
If you've always wanted to be a selector of shorts yourself, here's your chance. On June 9th, 2010, Selected Shorts at Symphony Space in New York will feature published stories selected by you, our audience nationwide. Go to selectedshorts.org/favorite to submit your story suggestions. Then, in the spring, you'll vote for your favorite of the final contenders. And second, if you've always wanted to try your own hand at writing a short story of your own, enter the annual Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Contest to be judged this year by Nathan Englander. Complete information about the contest can be found at selectedshorts.org.